The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Crypto, a daily Bloomberg iHeart podcast. And I'm Stacey Marie Ishmael, managing editor of crypto for Bloomberg News. Let me cut to the chase. Matt Levine, my colleague on the Bloomberg Opinion side of the house, is perhaps the greatest finance blogger ever to do it. And in what is both a flex and a service, he's just written tens of thousands of words on the subject of crypto for a special issue of Bloomberg Business Week. Matt's gone deep into the blockchain to break down its origins, its possible futures, and the current state of a technology that's showing up everywhere in industries ranging from finance to shipping to, of course, video games. And we're going to be bringing his exploration to you in audio form. Thanks to the talents of Bloomberg editor and professional voice actor Mark Ladoff, you'll get weekly chapters of the special crypto issue of Bloomberg Business Week. Welcome to the fifth chapter of the special audio edition of the Bloomberg Business Week crypto issue, written by Matt Levine and narrated by Mark Ladoff. Missed a chapter? Need to catch up? You can find previous episodes right here in the Bloomberg Crypto podcast feed.
Part 3. The Crypto Financial System. Let's step back a bit and abstract from what we've discussed so far. Crypto is, 1, a set of tokens which are worth fluctuating amounts of money. We can say that these tokens are financial assets, like stocks and bonds. 2, a novel set of ways to create new tokens and distribute them and try to make them worth money. 3, a novel way of holding financial assets. Instead of the databases that people use to hold stocks and bonds, you can own your own crypto on the blockchain. 4. A novel way to write contracts and computer programs that are contracts and contracts that are computer programs. If you read only that description, you might object. Yes, fine, but what is crypto for? What do these tokens do? Why are they worth money? Nothing in that description answers those objections. I suppose the last one does, in a sense. Crypto tokens are for building smart contracts for trading crypto tokens. But it's not a very good answer, because it's entirely self-referential. Yes, fine, but why are you trading the tokens in the first place? And you might have another complaint. Classically, a financial asset means a contractual claim on the cash flows of some person or entity. A share of stock represents a claim on the profits of a company. A bond represents a claim on repayment from a company or government, etc. My financial asset represents a liability or equity issuance of somebody else. Each financial asset has both an owner and an obliger. Some crypto, I would argue, looks a lot like that. It's an equity claim on the value of some crypto-y business. But a lot of crypto is consciously not like that. Bitcoin is digital gold. It's specifically not a financial asset. Owning a Bitcoin doesn't represent a claim on anyone else. A Bitcoin exists as an independent thing that you can own, not a contractual relationship between parties like stock or a bond. In the text, I use financial asset in the extremely loose sense of like a thing with a fluctuating price that you can see on your computer screen and that hedge funds can trade. But cryptocurrencies aren't technically financial assets, or not always, anyway. But for now, I want to set such objections to the side. If you're a certain sort of financial person, a financial engineer, an arbitrager, a market structure enthusiast, a builder of high-frequency trading systems, this abstract set of facts is incredibly, incredibly beautiful. You wake up one day and there's just a whole other financial system. It's full of smart people building interesting things, and it's full of idiots making terrible mistakes. People have built brilliant new ways to make financial bets that you can use, and they've built insane new ways to make financial bets that you can exploit. How can you not want to join in? It's so interesting, so intellectually appealing, such a blank canvas for all of your aesthetic views about how markets should work. Also, so many idiots are getting rich. Why shouldn't you? There are other appealing properties when you compare this system to traditional finance. The crypto system is, philosophically, one of permissionless innovation. The workings of the major blockchains are public and open source. If you want to build a derivatives exchange or margin lending protocol or whatever in Ethereum, you just do it. You don't need to set up a meeting with Vitalik Buterin to get his approval. You don't need to negotiate access and fees with the Ethereum Corp. There is no Ethereum Corp. Anyone can try anything and see if it works. If you're a smart young person coming from traditional finance, this feels liberating. If you're used to spending months negotiating credit agreements with prime brokers and setting up direct access to trade on a stock exchange, the idea that you can just do stuff in crypto with no preliminaries is amazing. Obviously, it's a bit alarming as well. Some of those long, slow processes in traditional finance are there to prevent money laundering or fraud or ill-considered risk-taking. But empirically, a lot of them aren't really preventing any of those things and aren't doing so in an optimal way. A lot of them are just how it's always been done. Nothing in crypto is how it's always been done. It's all too new. And so people invented a financial system for crypto. It runs alongside the traditional financial system, though they touch at many points. In some ways, it looks a lot like a copy of the traditional financial system. In other ways, it looks totally different. In some ways, it's a streamlined and modernized and innovative evolution of the traditional system. In other ways, it's a chaotic and stupid devolution of the traditional system, a version of traditional finance, TradFi, as crypto people call it, that unlearned important historic lessons about fraud and leverage and risk and regulation. It's so fun. Let's talk about it. A. Your keys, your coins, your hard drive in a garbage dump. 1. Holding crypto. Maybe the first thing to say about the crypto financial system is that the traditional financial system is deeply intermediated, and the crypto system is not. If you have money, your bank tracks your money for you. If you have stock, your broker tracks your stock for you, etc. One dumb, simple thing that this means, if you have money in the bank, your bank has to give it to you. If you forget the PIN code for your ATM card, or if you forget the password for your online banking, you'll have a hard time taking out money, and that will be inconvenient for you. But the bank owes you the money. They can't just be like, aha, got you, the money is ours now. There's some process by which you can go into the bank and prove that you are who you say you are, and they're like, fine, we'll reset your password, it's test 1234, don't forget this time. Crypto doesn't necessarily work like that. Owning Bitcoin means 1. Having a public Bitcoin address with some Bitcoin in it, and 2. Possessing the private key to that address. If you have the public address-private key pair, then you own the Bitcoin. You can transfer them to someone else on the blockchain. If you don't have that pair, then you can't. If you lose your private key or lose track of your public address, there's no one to recover your password for you or give you back your Bitcoin. They're just gone. There are ways to, you know, not lose your keys. Mainly people use software wallets, which generate and keep track of their addresses and private keys and allow them to sign transactions and send and receive crypto online. The wallets may be desktop or phone apps or extensions on a browser. Most modern wallets require you to keep track not of private keys, but rather a seed phrase of typically 12 random-looking words. Maybe Army Truth Speak Average, and so on. The phrase can be used as a seed to generate lots of public-private key pairs, so the wallet can create lots of different addresses that can all be recovered from a single seed phrase. People often speak of wallets holding crypto, but really what they have are these keys for various addresses. The crypto is only ever on the blockchain. Then you write the seed phrase down on a piece of paper, which is easier to write than a long random number. But this is a developing technology, and there's a long history of people losing, forgetting, or throwing away their private keys or seed phrases. A guy in Wales named James Howells periodically pops up in the news because he threw away a hard drive with the private key for 8,000 Bitcoin. He's pretty sure he knows the garbage dump that has his hard drive, and for years he's been waging a campaign to dig up the dump and sift through the garbage. If he finds the hard drive and if it still works, then he'll have Bitcoin worth about $150 million, which he can use to pay all the garbage diggers. In one sense, it would be much, much better to have a financial system in which the bank could reset his password and give him back the 8,000 Bitcoin instead of digging up a garbage dump. In another sense, this is an extremely funny financial system, and there's a charm to that. 2. Not holding crypto. If you're a portfolio manager at an institutional investor and you want to buy Bitcoin, and you go to your compliance and operations people and say, "I want to buy Bitcoin, and I will write our private keys down on a post-it that I will keep next to my computer," they will say no. If you propose better security measures, they might still say no. This stuff is too new, too scary. If you say, "Megabank Custody Services will hold our Bitcoin for us, and we'll just have a book entry on their ledger saying we have Bitcoin," then compliance might be a bit more comfortable, but that requires Megabank to offer that service. But what if you go to your compliance and say, "I'm just going to enter into a bet with a hedge fund on the price of Bitcoin. For every dollar that Bitcoin goes up, the hedge fund will pay us $5. For every dollar that it goes down, we'll pay them $5. Then you don't have to own crypto at all. All you have is an over-the-counter derivative with a hedge fund. Compliance knows what that is. That's an understandable thing. There are no weird custody issues there because there's nothing to keep custody of. There are no weird coins to worry about, just a contract with a hedge fund to pay you money. You can write contracts on the price of corn, on interest rates, and on hurricane damage, so why not Bitcoin? You do due diligence on the hedge fund, you get comfortable with the credit and collateral terms, and then you sign the contract. And then, economically, you own some Bitcoin. Your investment goes up when Bitcoin goes up, and down when Bitcoin goes down, without the worries of really owning Bitcoin. No keys to lose. And so, in traditional finance, there's a big business offering those instruments. CME Group Inc. offers Bitcoin futures, which are basically the bet that I outlined above. You pay me $5 for every dollar that Bitcoin goes up, and I pay you $5 for every dollar it goes down. It's a trusted, centralized, traditional finance way to bet on the price movements of Bitcoin. Still, not everyone can buy futures, which require a lot of money and aren't offered by some retail brokerages. In the U.S. financial system, pretty much the easiest thing to invest in is stocks. So wrapping Bitcoin in a stock would increase its appeal. The easiest way to do this would be a cash Bitcoin exchange-traded fund, a pot of money that trades like a stock on a stock exchange and invests the money in Bitcoin. People keep trying to do this, but the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission remains skeptical and hasn't approved cash Bitcoin ETFs, though they exist in some other countries. The U.S. has, however, approved Bitcoin futures ETFs, which invest in Bitcoin through futures contracts. Two layers of abstraction: a Bitcoin wrapped in a futures contract, wrapped in a stock, and delivered to your brokerage account. B. CeFi. 1. Fiat on-ramps. Okay, I said one way to own a Bitcoin is to write your private key on a post-it note. But where did you get that Bitcoin? In the early days of Bitcoin, a reasonably plausible answer would be, I mined it. Every Bitcoin ever created has come from mining, and early Bitcoin was in part a hobbyist mining operation. In modern crypto, you're not going to get very far just by mining crypto on your home computer. The main way people in most of the world get into crypto is that they exchange dollars, or euros, pounds, yuan, etc., what crypto people call fiat, for crypto. And how they do that is a tricky question. One simple way is for you to find someone with crypto and say, hey, can I buy some of your crypto? They say sure, and you arrange a deal. In researching this article, I set up an Ethereum wallet and texted a friend to ask if he had any Ether I could buy. He replied, sure, and I said, send me $20 worth, and gave him my public address. He sent me $20 of Ether, and then he texted me to say, done, Venmo me $20. I did, and our transaction was complete. He sent me the Ether before I sent him the dollars, so he took some credit risk. And in fact, I was away from my phone when he sent it, so he ended up taking my credit risk for several hours. When I did get his text, I briefly considered that it would be very funny if, as part of my research for this article, I stole $20 of Ether from him. But that seemed mean. Just so you know, Bloomberg's Code of Journalistic Ethics forbids journalists who write about crypto, including me, from owning more than a nominal amount of crypto for research purposes. This rule itself is arguably biasing. It forbids crypto enthusiasts from writing about crypto, but never mind. In researching this article, I bought $20 of Ether from a friend by Venmo and $100 of Ether from Coinbase. This also led to Coinbase giving me like $5 of free Bitcoin as a new account bonus. In seeking permission to do this, I told my bosses that, one, I planned to lose all my money, but two, if I accidentally made any profit, I would donate it. I did spend like $8 of Ether on the MatthewLevine.eth domain. I'm not going to lie. This was fun to do and fun to write about. It felt sillier and more exciting than my automatic monthly Vanguard investments. But it's not a good way to run a financial system. Incidentally, the day after I did that trade, I met with the team behind a decentralized finance protocol and was like, well, how would you quickly turn dollars into Ether in New York? And they had no great answers and were like, we're working on it. And I was like, well, I texted a friend for Ether and then Venmoed him the money. And they were like, yeah, that's probably what we would do. In general, if you get a text asking you to send crypto to a string of letters and numbers, you should throw your phone into the ocean. Instead, the main way that normal people buy crypto is through crypto exchanges, specifically centralized crypto exchanges. Crypto exchanges are companies. Coinbase, Gemini, Binance, FTX, Kraken, and Bitfinex are some big ones that accept regular money for crypto. You wire an exchange $100, and it gives you $100 worth of Bitcoin, perhaps minus a fee. In the olden days, the stereotype was that a lot of crypto exchanges were run by criminals or incompetent teenagers, or incompetent teenage criminals. The standard crypto exchange transaction was, one, you exchange your dollars for Bitcoin to buy heroin, and then, two, the exchange got hacked and lost your Bitcoin before you could even buy the heroin. Modern crypto exchanges are less like that. For one thing, they're more careful and technically adept, so they're less likely to lose your Bitcoin. For another thing, though, they're big companies. Regulators are aware of them, and they try to be good corporate citizens. In their role as on-ramps and off-ramps between traditional currencies and crypto, they do the same sorts of anti-money laundering and know-your-customer checks that traditional banks and brokerages do. If you show up at Coinbase, a U.S. public company, with a sack of dollar bills that you got from dealing heroin and try to convert them into Bitcoin, Coinbase will turn you away and probably report you to the police. The centralized exchanges are very much part of the regulated financial system these days. The days of crypto being a zone of utter lawlessness are mostly gone. This is a series of trade-offs. Roughly speaking, the crypto exchanges of the olden days let you trade dollars for Bitcoin without asking any questions, but they might steal your Bitcoin. When the exchanges were unregulated and crime positive, the odds of them doing crime to you, or having crime done to them, were pretty high. The modern crypto exchanges ask a lot of questions and make it difficult for you to move tons of money in secret, but they probably won't steal your Bitcoin. 2. Custodians. So you've opened an account at an exchange and sent the exchange $100 to buy $100 worth of Bitcoin. What does the exchange give you for your $100? One possibility, it gives you 0.005215 Bitcoin. It sends you some instructions on how to set up a Bitcoin wallet. It asks you for a public Bitcoin address. It converts $100 to Bitcoin at the current market price, and it sends you that number of Bitcoin at your public address. And then you access those Bitcoin using your private key for that address. This is suboptimal for the exchange. For one thing, dollar and Bitcoin transactions have different time frames and finality. If you fund your account with a bank transfer or a credit card, and then you buy $100 of Bitcoin, and then you call your bank and say, "I've been defrauded, I don't recognize that charge," there's a decent chance the bank will take the $100 from the exchange and give it back to you. Meanwhile, the Bitcoin transfer to your wallet is fast and irreversible. For another thing, you know the exchange will get some customers who don't write down their wallet's seed phrase, or lose it or forget it, and then can't access the Bitcoin. And they'll call the exchange's customer service number and say, "I lost the password to my Bitcoin account. Can you reset it?" And the exchange will say, "No, it doesn't work that way. Also, we don't have a customer service number." And the customers won't like it. "I paid you $100 for Bitcoin and I don't have the Bitcoin," they'll say, and blame the exchange and complain to regulators and law enforcement and the press, and especially to their bank or credit card company. Now, these problems are annoying but solvable, and modern crypto exchanges do some amount of this, acquiring crypto for self-custodying customers. But there's a simpler possibility that is also quite popular. The exchange could hang on to your Bitcoin for you. Instead of sending you 0.005215 Bitcoin on the Bitcoin blockchain, it could go out and buy 0.005215 Bitcoin and put them into its own Bitcoin wallet. Being a professional Bitcoin exchange, it could put in the effort to keep these Bitcoins safe and not lose the keys. And then instead of sending you 0.005215 Bitcoin, the exchange just keeps a database of its customers and their account balances. And your entry in the database includes your name, your driver's license number, your account number, your email address, your phone number, your password, just kidding, a hash of your password, your mother's maiden name, and your account balance, and the exchange writes 0.005215 in the balance field. And then when you log into your account, it displays 0.005215 Bitcoin as your account balance, and you think you own 0.005215 Bitcoin. And you're not exactly wrong, but really what you own is a claim on the exchange for 0.005215 Bitcoin. You don't own them directly, and you don't control the private key. You just have an entry on the ledger of the exchange. You know, like a bank. If you have a bank account, the bank owes you money, and you trust it to keep a record of that. If you have a crypto exchange account, it's the same, but the exchange owes you Bitcoin. One thing this means is that if you lose your password, you can call the exchange and it can reset it for you. The customer service can be a bit better. There are some obvious downsides. One big one, it's like a bank. If you got into Bitcoin because you don't trust banks and you want to be in control of your own money, it's somewhat weird, philosophically, to just go and trust a crypto exchange to keep your money for you. These days, the big crypto exchanges seem to be mostly law-abiding. And you can get rich enough running a legitimate crypto exchange that it seems silly to steal the money instead. But another downside is hackers. A crypto exchange has a giant pot of money, and it has to move that money around a lot to deal with customer transactions. It's an appealing target for hackers looking to steal private keys. Again, modern crypto exchanges spend a lot of money on information security, but that wasn't always the case, and there's a long history of Bitcoin exchanges being hacked. Or quote-unquote hacked. When all the Bitcoin in an exchange's wallet gets stolen, it can be hard to tell sometimes whether they were stolen by outside hackers or by the exchange's CEO. Also, while I suppose an exchange is less likely to lose its private keys than the average customer is, it can happen. In 2018, the CEO of Quadriga FinTech Solutions Corp. died in somewhat mysterious circumstances while on vacation in India. At the time, the company's Quadriga CX was Canada's largest crypto exchange, and it was apparently run entirely off of its CEO's laptop. When he died, he took all of Quadriga's private keys with him, meaning its customers' Bitcoin were lost forever. Or that's what it would have meant, except that before he died, he also stole all the customers' Bitcoin, so the wallets whose keys disappeared with him were empty anyway. When crypto exchanges are bad, they tend to be bad in all ways at once. 3. Also exchanges, though. Centralized crypto exchanges are on-ramps to crypto for people with dollars and other traditional currencies, but they're also exchanges. If you have some Bitcoin in your Coinbase account and you'd rather have Ether, you can sell your Bitcoin for Ether. If you want to actively trade among cryptocurrencies to make bets on which will go up more, you can do that on an exchange. In traditional finance, there tends to be a division between exchanges and brokerages. If you want to buy stock, you open an account at a brokerage, such as Charles Schwab, Fidelity, or Robinhood, and you send your broker an order to buy stock. The stock exchange is a place for big brokerages and institutions to trade stock. Retail customers need an account with a broker to access the exchange. In practice, modern U.S. stock trading is even more intermediated than this, and your order may get sent to an electronic trading firm and not the stock exchange. There are many layers of intermediation. In crypto, that's not generally true. Big crypto exchanges such as Coinbase or FTX let anyone open an account and trade crypto directly on the exchange, and you wouldn't normally connect to the exchange through a broker. Though traditional retail stock brokerages are increasingly getting into the business of buying crypto for their customers. Every step that goes into making a trade happen, getting your money into the account, taking your buy order, matching your order with someone else's sell order, settling the trade, putting the crypto in your account, keeping track of your account, is done by the exchange. Let me spend a bit more time on one of those functions, providing leverage. If Bitcoin isn't exciting enough for you, you can find an exchange that will let you borrow money to buy more of it. You put in $100, the exchange lends you $900, you get $1,000 worth of Bitcoin. If Bitcoin goes up 10%, you double your money. If Bitcoin goes down 10%, you lose everything. Bitcoin goes up and down by 10% a lot, so this is an exciting way to gamble. Traditional finance also provides leverage, but it's a complex and intermediated system involving brokers and clearinghouses. Crypto exchanges are more integrated, so in many cases, a crypto exchange is basically in the business of managing market risk. Say instead of Bitcoin going down 10%, it falls 15%. You're not only down your original $100, but now you owe $50. Crypto exchanges have to decide when to make you post collateral, put up more money, to ensure that you're good for your losses, and when to liquidate your position so you don't lose more than you can pay back. A crypto exchange may have customers with big leveraged bets on Bitcoin rising. They're long in the language of finance, and customers with big leveraged bets against Bitcoin. They're short. If Bitcoin moves too far in one direction too quickly, then the long or short customers will be out of money, which means there won't be money to pay back the short or long customers on the other side. The exchange has to think about how volatile its assets are, set leverage limits so blowups are unlikely, and monitor leverage levels to ensure no one is in imminent danger of blowing up. If someone is likely to blow up, the exchange has to seize their collateral and sell it, ideally in an intelligent way that doesn't destabilize the market too much. And in periods of high volatility, the exchange might shut down trading rather than deal with all this. That's a lot of centralized decision-making.
We'll be right back with more from Bloomberg Businessweek special crypto issue, written by Matt Levine and narrated by Mark Ledorf.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline, it's teamwork, and it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
C, stablecoins. Bitcoin is good at keeping track of who has Bitcoin. This is technologically interesting and also useful insofar as Bitcoin are a store of wealth. And if Bitcoin were the dominant currency in the world, if it were digital cash and you could use it to buy stuff and the prices of things were set in Bitcoin, then it would be even more useful. But it isn't. You use dollars or pounds or yen or euros to buy stuff, and the price of Bitcoin in dollars, etc., is very volatile. One thing that would be cool is if crypto could keep track of who has dollars. Then you could get the benefits of crypto, decentralization, smart contracts, skirting the law, along with the benefits of dollars. Your bank account isn't incredibly volatile. You can buy a sandwich. A stablecoin is a crypto token that's supposed to always be worth $1, or one unit of some other traditional currency, though I'll stick to dollars. If you have a stablecoin, then you have $1 on the blockchain. You hope. 1. Collateralized. The simplest sort of stablecoin is what's sometimes called a fully backed stablecoin. Popular examples include USDC and Tether. The idea here is, 1. Some reasonably trustworthy institution sets up a stablecoin factory to issue stablecoins on one or more popular blockchains. 2. You give the issuer $1. 3. It gives you back one stablecoin. 4. It puts the dollar somewhere safe. 5. If you ever want your dollar back, you give the issuer one stablecoin and it gives you back the dollar. Or maybe not you, but an institutional investor. This description makes a stablecoin issuer an on-off ramp between regular currency and crypto, which is risky for the reasons we discussed earlier, regulatory, credit, etc. If you want to hand the issuer a stablecoin and get back a dollar, it will probably at least want to do know-your-customer checks to make sure it's okay to give you dollars. Or the issuer might limit redemptions to some list of large institutional investors, rather than letting just anyone show up with a stablecoin. This is probably fine. If there are enough institutions who can redeem stablecoins for dollars, then they will buy stablecoins for around a dollar, and you can just sell your stablecoins to them. Your stablecoin lives on some blockchain and can be traded and used like any other token on that blockchain. Most of the big stablecoin issuers issue on multiple blockchains. Tether lives mostly on Tron and Ethereum. USDC lives mostly on Ethereum, but is also on Solana, Tron, Avalanche, and to a lesser extent, four other blockchains. If you have $10,000 stablecoins on the Ethereum blockchain and you want to buy some Ether, you can buy $10,000 worth of Ether with your stablecoins without putting more dollars in. And if you have $10,000 worth of Ether, you can sell it for $10,000 stablecoins. Having $10,000 stablecoins is like having $10,000, but the stablecoins live on the blockchain, in your crypto wallet, rather than in a bank account. This is useful if, for instance, you don't have a bank account, or if you don't live in the U.S. and it's hard for you to set up a dollar-denominated bank account. Or if you plan to use the $10,000 to buy more crypto later and you don't want to move it back and forth between the regular and crypto financial systems. Or if you want to send the $10,000 to a smart contract, which can deal directly with your crypto wallet, but which has a hard time talking to a bank. Banks are suspicious of crypto, and crypto is suspicious of banks, so it's always a bit painful to connect the crypto system to a bank. This smart contract will send me dollars if the Jets win this weekend. No, bad, doesn't work. This smart contract will send me stablecoins if the Jets win. Yes, fine. Stablecoins are wrapped dollars, dollars that live on the blockchain. More generally, this is useful if you think the crypto financial system is better than the traditional one. If sending tokens over a crypto blockchain is faster and cheaper than sending dollars by interbank transfer, then stablecoins are a better way to send dollars. If the blockchain lets you develop interesting derivatives contracts and trading applications in a quick and permissionless way, and the traditional financial system doesn't, you'll want to use stablecoins instead of regular old dollars. One important point about the collateralized stablecoin model is that it requires you to trust the issuer. The dollarness of the stablecoin happens, as it were, entirely off the blockchain. As a crypto matter, what you have is a receipt for $1 from some institution that you trust. If that institution incinerates all the dollars, that receipt shouldn't be worth a dollar. One of the longest-running and funniest controversies in crypto is about where Tether, the biggest stablecoin, keeps its money. Tether is replete with colorful characters, the Mighty Ducks guy, etc., and they go around boasting about how transparent they are without actually saying where the money is. They also go around promising to publish an audit, but never do it. They probably have the money, more or less, but they seem to be going out of their way to seem untrustworthy. Still, people trust them. 1. You can collateralize other things. The collateralized stablecoin model is a way to wrap non-crypto assets and put them on the blockchain. You could imagine all sorts of assets getting wrapped. For instance, what if you wanted to trade stocks, but in crypto? You might want to do this for reasons similar to why you might want to have dollars, but in crypto. You like the crypto system, the smart contracts, the permissionless innovation, the decentralized exchanges, frankly, the lack of regulation. But you also like stocks, which represent ownership in productive enterprises and are also a very popular tool for speculation. The crypto system doesn't talk all that well to the stocks system. Your broker is suspicious of crypto, and crypto is suspicious of your broker, less and less so, but still. Putting the stocks on the blockchain lets you trade the things you want, stocks, the way you want, in crypto. Conceptually, one way to do this is that some fairly trustworthy institution buys a bunch of Tesla Inc. stock and holds it in its vault, and then it issues wrapped Tesla tokens on some blockchain. Each WTSLA token corresponds to one share of Tesla that the institution has in its vault, and you can trade them on the blockchain exactly as you would Ether. And in fact, this exists. FTX, a leading centralized crypto exchange, offers tokenized stocks on the Solana blockchain, though not to U.S. customers. Binance, another leading exchange, offered tokenized stocks for a while, but then stopped. If you're going to try this, you'll want to run it by your local securities regulator. It's legally sensitive to find new ways to sell people new, not quite stocks. But if it works, it's interesting. For a crypto exchange, it's a way to keep your retail gamblers gambling on your platform. Someone who wants to bet on Bitcoin and Ether and Tesla stock can do all of it on one crypto exchange. More broadly, though, it's a way for the crypto financial system to ingest the traditional financial system. Have a financial asset? Put it in a box and issue tokens about it. Now it's a crypto asset. If the crypto financial system is good, if the computer programs, payment rails, and institutional structures of crypto have competitive advantages against the programs, rails, and structures of traditional finance, then some people will prefer to trade their stocks or bonds or other financial assets in the crypto system. 2. Algorithmic. The fully backed stablecoin model has problems. One is that you might not trust the issuer of a backed stablecoin. Another is that you might not want to trust any issuer. An issuer of a fully backed stablecoin is by necessity using the U.S. dollar financial system. It's keeping the backing dollars in a bank or in other traditional finance dollar instruments. It might be subject to the regulatory pressures of that system. What you want is something that's worth a dollar but exists purely on the blockchain. Can that be done? 1. Good algorithmic. Sure, and with a fairly simple and traditional bit of financial engineering. It starts with leverage, or just borrowing money. Leverage is a way to amplify the risks and returns of betting on crypto. Instead of putting in $100 and buying $100 worth of Bitcoin and making $10 if Bitcoin goes up 10%, I put in $100 and borrow $100 and buy $200 worth of Bitcoin and make $20 if Bitcoin goes up 10%. Or I lose $20 if Bitcoin goes down 10%. Or I lose everything if Bitcoin goes down 50%. For me, that's a high-risk, high-reward proposition. But what if I borrowed the money from you? What does that proposition look like for you? Well, if Bitcoin goes up 10%, you get back $100. I sell my Bitcoin for $220, give you back $100, and keep the rest. And likewise, if Bitcoin goes up 20%, you get back $100. I sell 240, give you back 100, and keep 140. If Bitcoin goes down 20%, you get back $100. I sell for 160, give you back 100, and keep 60. If Bitcoin goes down 49.5%, you get back $100. I sell for 101, give you back 100, and keep $1. Let's stop there, for no particular reason. At every point that I've named so far, you get back $100. You put in $100, and you get back $100, no matter what. For me, this trade is very risky. If Bitcoin fell 49.5%, I lost 99%. For you, this trade is very safe, very stable. What you have is a stable coin. You put in $100 and get back $100. This basic idea is called an algorithmic stablecoin. You put in $100 and get back a thing that's worth $100, with that value guaranteed by a larger amount of a volatile cryptocurrency. I've described this as just a direct loan from you to me, a contract, but ordinarily this would be done as a smart contract, a computer program on a blockchain. Vitalik describes a rudimentary form of this in the original Ethereum white paper, calling it a hedging contract. Here's a slightly different example that involves no dollars at all. Say you and I each put 1,000 Ether into a smart contract, and that when we do it, 1,000 Ether is worth $1 million. On some preset maturity date, the contract will send you $1 million worth of Ether, and I will get whatever Ether is left. If Ether doubled in value in that time, that means you'll get 500 Ether worth $1 million, and I'll get 1,500 Ether worth $3 million. On the other hand, if Ether's dollar value fell 50%, you get all the Ether in the pool, so you get your $1 million back, and I get nothing. You get back $1 million no matter what. The smart contract, though, never held any dollars at all. There's no bank account, no treasury bills, no trusted central intermediary, but you have a claim with a steady value in U.S. dollars. We have, in a way, manufactured dollars purely out of crypto. A few points. First, I'm being far too cute here. In my original example, if the price of Bitcoin falls by 51%, my $200 worth of Bitcoin will be worth $98, and I won't have enough money to pay you back. Your supposed stablecoin is worth 98 cents. Can the price of Bitcoin fall by more than 50%? Oh yes, absolutely. It did that this year. It's not easy to manufacture stablecoins out of extremely unstable assets. Your algorithmic stablecoin has some risk of becoming unstable, but you can do a little better than the crude version I've proposed here. You could have margin calls, for instance, so that if Bitcoin falls by more than 20%, the smart contract sells the remaining Bitcoin to pay me back immediately. Actual algorithmic stablecoins, DAI, the stablecoin of MakerDAO, is a big one, work this way. Second, I am omitting interest. In the real world, if I'm borrowing $100 from you to buy Bitcoin, I'm not just paying you back $100. I'm paying you back with interest, $101 or whatever. An algorithmic stablecoin, much like a dollar in a bank account, can potentially generate interest. Third, note that there are two sides to this trade. Some people want stablecoins and will put money, or Ether, Bitcoin, etc., into this sort of smart contract to get stablecoins. Others want leverage and will borrow money from this sort of smart contract to take leveraged positions in risky crypto assets. There are different appetites for risk, so there's a trade to be done. Fourth, do you know what a bank is? Not in crypto, just in the world? Here's what a bank is. Some people want to borrow money to make investments. The main investments are 1, starting or expanding a business, and 2, buying real estate. They borrow money from a bank, they get leverage. If their business does well or their house's price goes up, they pay back the money to the bank with interest. The bank has the senior claim on their business or house. If there isn't enough money for everyone, the bank gets paid first. Sometimes the bank loses money, but mostly it gets paid back on most of its loans. The bank, then, is just a pool of these loans, just a lot of senior claims on a lot of businesses and houses. These loans are called the bank's assets. Then the bank itself goes and borrows money. A bank with $10 billion of assets, $10 billion of mortgages and business loans, might have $1 billion of its shareholders' money, equity, or for a bank, capital, and borrow the other $9 billion. It borrows the $9 billion from its customers in the form of deposits. A bank deposit is, formally, a loan to the bank. If you deposit $100, the bank owes you that $100, and it uses that $100 to fund loans to businesses and homebuyers. Wait, though. I said way earlier that a dollar is just an entry in the bank's database. When you have a dollar, what you have is an entry on the books of the bank. That deposit is the dollar. The deposit is the dollar, and yet it's also the debt of the bank. Your entry on the bank's database shows both that the bank owes you a dollar and is the dollar that you own. Isn't that incoherent? How can the bank owe you the dollar if you have it already right there in your account? Yes, that's what a dollar is. A dollar is debt. The modern banking system is a machine that takes in risky assets at one end, takes senior claims on them, lending money against those assets with the right to be paid back first, and repeats that move a few times, taking and issuing senior claims on the senior claims. In practice, this can be repeated many times. Banks would sometimes buy senior tranches of collateralized debt obligations made up of senior tranches of mortgage-backed securities made up of senior loans on houses. At the other end of all this, it spits out dollars. A dollar is distilled from risky assets. The stablecoin thing is nothing new. It's just banking, but banking in a particularly clear way, and in a largely unregulated way at the moment, and without deposit insurance, purified in smart contracts on the blockchain.
Coming up next, you'll hear more from Matt Levine's special crypto issue of Bloomberg Businessweek, narrated by Mark Ledorf.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Two, bad algorithmic. To summarize the previous section, if you have a large quantity of risky tokens, you can, with a little financial engineering, issue a smaller quantity of claims on those tokens and call them stable coins. But recall also one of the simplest lessons of Bitcoin, which is that you can make up an arbitrary token that trades electronically and people might pay you money for it. Worth a shot, no? These two insights, you can make up a token and it will be worth money, and you can use claims on risky tokens to make a stablecoin, can be combined in a natural way to create a disaster. Here's the disaster. One, I make up a cryptocurrency. Call it Sharecoin. I list it on exchanges and try to sell it to people for some money. Maybe Bitcoin or Ether or dollars or Korean won. It doesn't matter. Two, I make up another cryptocurrency. Call it Dollarcoin. I set up a smart contract saying that one Dollarcoin can always be exchanged for $1 worth of Sharecoin. I can do this because I just made up Sharecoin, and the smart contract can issue any old amount of it. If Sharecoin trades at $20, the smart contract will give you 0.05 Sharecoins per Dollarcoin. If it trades at $0.001, the smart contract will give you 1,000 Sharecoins. It doesn't care. It can make all the Sharecoins it wants. 3. Conversely, if you want dollar coins, you buy $1 worth of Sharecoins and deliver them to the smart contract to get back a dollar coin. 4. As long as there's some price for Sharecoin, the smart contract can issue a dollar's worth of Sharecoins for any dollar coin that someone brings to exchange. 5. See, a dollar coin should always be worth a dollar, I say, through the power of algorithms. The flaw in this logic is in step 4. There's absolutely no reason for Sharecoin to be worth anything at all. I just made it up. And so no reason for a dollar coin to be worth a dollar. But of course, everything in crypto was made up by somebody in the recent past, so this objection is not as compelling as you might think. People might believe in this story or just in the general vibe of Sharecoin and Dollarcoin. They might buy Dollarcoin and treat it as worth a dollar, and buy Sharecoin and treat it as a valuable component of a thriving ecosystem. At some point, the process reverses. People start to want dollars rather than dollar coins, so some of them sell dollar coins for dollars on the open market. This pushes the price of dollar coin slightly below $1, perhaps to 99 cents. Other people get nervous, so they go to the smart contract, which is supposed to keep the price of a dollar coin at $1, and trade dollar coins in for $1 worth of Sharecoins. They sell those Sharecoins, which pushes down the price of Sharecoin, which makes more people nervous. They trade even more dollar coins for Sharecoins and sell those. This pushes the price of Sharecoin lower, which creates more nervousness, which leads to more redemptions at lower Sharecoin prices and even more Sharecoin supply flooding the market. This is a well-known phenomenon in traditional finance. It happens when companies issue debt and commit to paying it back with stock. And it has the technical name death spiral. It's as bad as it sounds. A couple of algorithmic stablecoins have death spiraled, the most famous one being Terra USD. Terra was a blockchain ecosystem with a native currency, like our Sharecoin, called Luna, and a stablecoin called Terra USD. Billions of dollars of Terra USD were issued, backed by algorithmic conversion into $1 worth of Luna. Terra USD was popular because stablecoins are popular, and also, to be fair, because you could get 20% interest rates on Terra USD. The total amount of Terra USD reached $18.5 billion. The market capitalization of Luna rose above $40 billion. The system all worked, and then it didn't. A quick death spiral hit in May, and Terra unraveled completely. By the end of the month, Terra USD was trading below 2 cents,
zillions of Luna had been issued and were trading at essentially zero, and the whole Terra blockchain had burned to the ground. Terra's founder, Do Kwon, colorful character, was tweeting in September that he wasn't on the run from South Korean authorities. Those authorities responded that he was obviously on the run.
Thank you, Matt Levine, and thank you, Mark Ladoff. As a reminder, if you're looking for these episodes in the crypto feed, we'll be publishing them every Sunday through December 18th. If you'd like to read this issue in print form, you can head on over to Bloomberg.com/thecryptostory. This is Bloomberg Crypto, a daily podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartRadio. For more shows from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Send us your comments, questions, or suggestions for the show to crypto@bloomberg.net, or find us on Twitter, we're at crypto. The supervising producer of Bloomberg Crypto is Vicky Vergolina. Our senior producer is Janet Babin. Our producers are Mohammed Farouk and Sharon Barrero. Our associate producers are Ty Butler and Moses Undum. Desta Wonderad is our engineer. Original music by Leo Sidran. I'm Stacey Marie Ishmael. We'll be back tomorrow.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.